Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday the 27th of August, these are our main stories. Opposition parties in Britain have agreed to work together in Parliament to block a no-deal Brexit. Kurdish forces in northern Syria are withdrawing from the border with Turkey after the United States brokered the establishment of a buffer zone. Brazil has rejected an offer of aid from G7 countries to tackle forest fires in the Amazon. Also in this podcast.
The next morning, you wake to find him sat on the side of the bed, gazing at you. He says that
last night was incredible.
Which you think is an overstatement.
Fans have been queuing for hours in London for tickets for the new stage version of the award-winning TV series Fleabag. First to Westminster, and the leaders of opposition parties in Britain say they've agreed to use legislation to block a no-deal Brexit. Parliament returns from its summer recess in a week's time. The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has promised to leave the EU by the end of October, with or without a deal, and has refused to rule out suspending Parliament if necessary. The Green Party politician Caroline Lucas was at the meeting of opposition parties.
It was a really constructive meeting, and there was complete unanimity around a number of issues. First of all, that a no-deal Brexit would be a catastrophe for this country and that we need to do whatever is necessary to avoid that. And crucially, that the legislative way forward is the most secure way to try to make sure that we can extend Article 50, that we can get rid of that 31st of October deadline.
I asked our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, what exactly is the plan now for the opposition parties?
Well, there's two strategies, basically. The main opposition Labour Party, the leader of that, Jeremy Corbyn, has been proposing a vote of no confidence in the government when it reconvenes on Tuesday next week. Now, other people have been opposed to that. They say that who would take over in that event? Mr Corbyn has said it would be him. It seems, though, that now a different strategy has emerged and that they want to pass legislation so that if there is no deal agreed between Boris Johnson and the EU ahead of the 31st October, then they will get that extension to Article 50. That's the strategy that's seen as the best way of holding this disparate collection of forces together. They include conservative rebels, people who are by no means in favour of, for example, Jeremy Corbyn taking over as a caretaker prime minister.
And actually, within the last 10 seconds or so, we've heard from Jeremy Corbyn, who said the opposition leaders have agreed on the urgency to act together to find practical ways to prevent a no deal, including the possibility of passing legislation and a vote of no confidence. So a lot of urgency, obviously. And Boris Johnson, he's still trying to get a deal with the EU or make changes to the existing deal.
He is indeed. He'll be speaking to Jean-Claude Juncker later on today for the second time since he took over as Prime Minister from Prime Minister Theresa May. He's also sending his chief Brexit negotiator to Brussels for talks tomorrow. He's desperate to get the controversial Irish backstop changed in the withdrawal agreement. He says it's undemocratic and that without changes to that, Britain will be leaving with or without a deal at the end of October.
Danny Eberhard. Kurdish fighters in northern Syria say they have withdrawn their forces, heavy weapons and fortifications from some positions on the border with Turkey. I asked our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, do we know what's behind this move?
Well, yes, what's behind this move is an attempt to try and stop another major escalation in fighting in this area. We've had two military offensives across the border by Turkey against both the Kurds and against ISIS in the past 3 years. Turkey's been threatening a third increasingly in recent months. And this is essentially about trying to drive the Syrian Kurdish forces back from the border. Turkey sees them as a threat, sees them as a terrorist group, which is linked, if not actually an integral part of Kurdish separatists in Turkey. So that's the reason behind it. And what the Kurds have said today is they've pulled back from some of their military positions along the border. What they've said, though, is that they're going as deep as up to, I think, 5 kilometres, which is not nearly as far as the Turks want, and that they're not going to pull out of towns or cities.
I mean, it's probably an understatement, but it's very complicated, isn't it? Because there's so many groups. And then the US has used Kurdish forces against the Islamic State group. So they see them as the goodies, and then the Turks see them totally different.
As the baddies.
Yeah, as the baddies, yeah.
That's basically the story of the Kurds in one conflict after another. And, I mean, their fear and people who've kind of supported them in their battle against ISIS, and they have played an absolutely essential part in that, have felt that the US were likely to cut and run again, having, as you say, made use of them. I mean, obviously, the Kurds couldn't have achieved their success without US support in the air and their training. But the US are very, very close to them. And with President Trump's decision to withdraw all US troops out, then the question became, what's going to happen to the Kurds? Now, there is some sense from this that the US, whether this is to try and calm the situation with Ankara or actually take some responsibility for the Kurds, is trying to find some way so there isn't an actual confrontation between the Turks and the Kurds, which has happened twice before. And in each case, the Turks were victorious over the Kurds.
That was Sebastian Usher. The Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has urged the United States to make the first step towards dialogue by lifting sanctions against Iran. Mr. Rouhani was speaking in a public address a day after President Trump said he was open to a meeting if the circumstances were right. Here's Charles Haviland.
There's been a downturn in relations between Washington and Tehran since the Trump administration withdrew last year from the Iran nuclear deal. Speaking on state television, President Rouhani said that if the US lifted its sanctions, bilateral relations might improve, and he sought again to reassure the US that Iran would never build a nuclear bomb. It had even issued a fatwa against doing so. Mr. Rouhani's relatively dovish approach isn't going down well with conservatives in Tehran. It's been criticised by a newspaper close to the Islamic Revolutionary Guards.
Charles Haviland. The Brazilian government has rejected an offer of $22 million in aid from G7 countries to help tackle fires in the Amazon. The Foreign Affairs Ministry told France it should first fulfil its commitment under the Paris Accord to help developing countries fight climate change. There are concerns that if fires are not brought under control, then indigenous groups who live and rely on the rainforest will cease to exist. Jonathan Mazawa is Communications Director for Survival International, a charity which campaigns for the rights of indigenous groups. Dan Damon began by asking him how particular groups are being affected by these fires.
Perhaps one of the most serious of all are the Awá tribe, who live in the southern Brazilian state of Maranhão, which is on the southern fringes of the Amazon, which is the area probably most affected by these fires. They've been battling these fires that are set by farmers and ranchers in the dry season for years. And obviously this year it's particularly bad. And they've been seeing a lot of a large proportion of their own territory go up in flames. And what makes it particularly serious is that there are uncontacted Indians, uncontacted members of the tribe living in that forest too. In previous years, there's been evidence after the fires that they've actually been fleeing the fires, trying to find areas of rainforest that are still intact in order to live there and try and get away from these infernos. And that's very likely to be happening again at the moment there. And that's just one example of dozens across Brazil and across the whole of the Amazon, actually, where, you know, indigenous lands, which have often been the last areas of rainforest still standing in a kind of sea of deforestation, they're increasingly now being targeted by ranchers and farmers and land grabbers in the dry season to burn the forest and then go in and clear what remains for farming and cattle ranching.
Is there any way to reconcile these totally different lifestyles, those who want to farm the land and those who want to live in it as it is?
Well, there's no way to reconcile them in the same place. But another way of looking at it is that there's an awful lot of land already cleared in Brazil. And of course, Brazil has one of the most unequal systems of land ownership in the world. So it's not like there isn't plenty of land already cleared. There are vast, vast areas, much of which was once, of course, indigenous land, but was cleared long ago. There's absolutely no need for the rainforest that remains, and particularly the indigenous territories, to be being burnt in this way.
The Brazilian government's rejected this $22 million or so that's been offered. How much difference would that have made?
Well, I suspect that if the indigenous people and their leaders had been offered this money, they'd have said, yes, please, we need all the help we can get. But unfortunately, you know, the Brazilian government at the moment is highly nationalistic and xenophobic. So it's not really surprising that they rejected it.
That was Jonathan Mazower from Survival International. In Sweden, it's relatively common for 18 and 19-year-olds to fly the nest. The average age for leaving home is 21, the youngest in Europe. However, what was once seen as a rite of passage is now raising concern, particularly about whether going solo too soon could contribute to mental health issues. Maddie Savage reports from Stockholm.
This is Vällingby. It's a purpose-built suburb packed with high-rise apartments. I'm on my way to meet a 21-year-old renter who's been living alone here for 2 years.
So, jag heter Ida Starberg.
My name is Ida Starberg. I'd always wanted to move out and I'd always felt ready. At first it was really nice, but after a few weeks I started to feel lonely. When I came home it was quiet and empty and there was nothing, only myself.
Bara mig själv.
Ida pays her rent and bills by working as a security guard. Her studio flat's around 30 square metres in size. It's sparsely decorated, just a wire butterfly hanging on the wall and photos of her family, who live on the other side of the city.
It became easy to start having a bad image of myself, or destructive thoughts.
More than half of all Swedish households are made up of people living alone, the highest proportion in the EU. This is partly down to rent controls and cities made up of compact apartments rather than townhouses that lend themselves to sharing with friends.
We have a tradition in Sweden, and our society is built on certain values that we should all manage ourselves. We should not be depending on each other as much as in other countries.
That's Karin Schultz from the mental health charity Mind.
Loneliness among young people is much higher than expected. One would think that elderly people are much more alone than younger, but it's relatively high among young people as well.
Loneliness is a hot topic, and entrepreneurs in Stockholm's strong startup scene have been coming up with solutions. My next stop is one of a growing number of co-living spaces in Stockholm. High-spec, grown-up versions of student dormitories for anything from 12 to 50 people that cost around the same as a solo apartment. Similar projects have already taken off in cities including San Francisco, London and Berlin. I'm here to meet one of the tenants, Michelle Axelson.
It's a way of meeting new people and you can have dinner parties and, I mean, you can choose if you want to be alone or if you want to be with someone.
But critics argue Sweden's individualistic culture is too deep-rooted for co-living to become mainstream. Back in Vällingby, even Ida Starberg says she wouldn't give up her solo lifestyle.
Although it is tough sometimes and I feel lonely, I still think of it as something really positive.
Her words recall an old Swedish proverb, ensam är stark, alone is strong.
Maddie Savage in Sweden. Later in the podcast.
First, curl up, get cozy, take a deep breath.
So, can soothing sleep stories help you get into a deep slumber? The Attorney General of the US state of Oklahoma, Mike Hunter, has welcomed a $572 million fine imposed on the pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson.
Judge Bachman has affirmed our position that Johnson & Johnson, motivated by greed and avarice, is responsible for the opioid epidemic in our state. Johnson & Johnson will finally be held accountable for thousands of deaths and addiction caused by their activities.
Investors had feared a much larger fine, and Johnson & Johnson shares traded 2% higher. Johnson & Johnson says it will appeal against the decision, which is being seen as a test case for litigation against drugs companies across the United States. Sabrina Strong is a lawyer for the company.
We are disappointed and disagree with the judge's decision. We believe that it is flawed. We have sympathy for all who suffer from substance abuse. But Johnson & Johnson did not cause the opioid abuse crisis here in Oklahoma or anywhere in this country. We do not believe that the facts or the law supports the decision today.
About 400,000 people have died from opioid overdoses over the past two decades. So how significant is this ruling against Johnson & Johnson, and what could be its impact? Shaima Khalil spoke to the emergency physician Chris Johnson in Minnesota, who's an expert on the opioid crisis.
That fine of $572 million was only in Oklahoma, which means you could have other states looking for similar damages that maybe, you know, get to that level. So now we're talking about a fine that isn't, you know, something you can just write a quick check for. That's cost of doing business. You know, we'll keep, you know, making $2 billion a year with this drug. Now you're talking about billions of dollars that they might be responsible for.
It's interesting, you know, hearing you talking numbers, because the prosecutors, I understand, had originally sought $17 billion in damages. They got half a billion. Do you think that this amount, huge as it is, $572 million in fines, do you think it will impact Johnson & Johnson and make them change or rethink their marketing strategies?
Not if it's a one-time fee of $570 million. Drug companies write that off all the time.
But that begs a bigger question, right? Who makes that decision to label something as okay to use on such frequent basis that it then causes addiction? But, you know, as a company, you're marketing as, you know, relieving pain, and, you know, we're helping so many people with so much pain. Where is the accountability? Who holds a company accountable before it reaches that level?
One company can't do it all, okay? The medical marketplace is a complicated interplay of governmental and approval agencies like the Food and Drug Administration. You have to reach the physicians because, you know, drug companies can't write the prescriptions themselves. They have to get the doctors to say it's okay and to allay their fears and saying use this product. They have a multi-pronged approach to changing the prescribing culture. And this is exactly what they did starting in the late 1990s. They hire prestigious thought leaders or pain experts at universities, and they get them to fudge the data and say these medicines are safer than we thought they were. And there really isn't evidence, but they're experts, and doctors aren't really good scientists. They're mostly just business people trying to run their clinic. So they're not really skeptical. They just kind of go with what the leader tells them. And so you get a prestigious, academic pain physician saying, oh, hey, we were wrong all the time. Look, and they start mining the data, the literature, and see if they can get a study here or there that they can twist and say it's safe. And that's what they did. They affected governmental agencies. They affected academic medicine, and they infiltrate patient advocacy groups, all of it.
Given the amount of attention this has been garnering, especially with America's opioid problems and the numbers that we've seen, do you think that this is a watershed moment, though, not just for Johnson & Johnson, but for the pharmaceutical industry at large?
I would like to think so. I would like to hope, honestly, that it's a watershed moment for the American medical system in general. Understand that, you know, Johnson & Johnson, you know, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, they are corporate sponsors for multiple, you know, physician bodies, including the American Academy of Family Physicians. These relationships with these drug companies and physicians is deep. They sponsor our conferences. They select the topics that get talked about and taught. They donate to our academic societies. And when you take their money, your voice is compromised. There's no way around this. We are muted as physicians in our response to this because, you know, we enjoy the lucre that they provide us.
That was Dr. Chris Johnson in Minnesota. The authorities in Hong Kong are keen to demonstrate that the protests there are not working. The city's leader, Carrie Lam, says she will not consider any of the protesters' demands until calm has been restored to Hong Kong. From there, Stephen McDonnell reports.
Speaking to reporters ahead of a weekly meeting of government ministers, Hong Kong's chief executive has again ruled out an independent inquiry into recent events here. Carrie Lam said it would be inappropriate to respond to any of the protesters' demands as long as there are violent clashes on the streets. She also said Hong Kong police were applying the lowest level of force they could in response to weapons being used by militant activists. However, many analysts have blamed Carrie Lam's administration for bungling the response to mass peaceful marches, leading to ever more violent pitched battles between militant youths and thousands of riot police.
That was Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. An Australian man who's been held in China for more than 7 months has been formally arrested for spying. Yang Huzhen, an academic and political commentator who was born in China, was detained in Guangzhou after flying in from New York. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Dr. Yang has been under investigation for allegedly harming China's national security. But Australian officials have been told he's now suspected of espionage. The former Chinese diplomat has been detained in Beijing without access to family or lawyers since January. The Australian government said the writer has been held in harsh conditions. Media reports have suggested that if convicted, he could face years in prison or the death penalty.
Well, Lawrence Pollard spoke to Dr. Yang's lawyer, Robert Sterry.
Firstly, Dr. Yang was placed in detention, effectively house arrest, for a period of 6 months from January of this year. And then today, Dr. Yang was charged with an offence of espionage. The charges haven't been particularised, so we don't know the precise nature of that allegation.
Do we know what he faces, possibly? I mean, give us an idea of the legal system that he's now caught up in.
Well, we know that espionage is a capital offence. That means it carries potentially the prospect of death penalty. And one would think that in a most serious example of espionage, that may be the penalty that's sought. But as I said, if his conduct is confined to his work simply as a democracy activist and blogger, then one would think that that sort of penalty would not be possible.
You said he's been in house arrest for all these months. Have you been in touch with him? Have his family supporters been in touch with him?
His wife, Yuan, is a permanent Australian resident, but she's been given an exit ban on leaving China. There's a prohibition on her leaving, and we've been in contact primarily through her. He's had consular access once per month. Coincidentally, he had contact today, and the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and the Foreign Affairs Minister have been monitoring his situation. Difficult situation whilst he's been in detention.
Mm. Have you been getting support from the government? What kind of noises have they made? Because the latest comments they've made seem to be quite strong in his support. But could the government do more? How do you interpret what they've done?
Well, you're correct in saying that the government's support at the moment is strong. The minister's expressed her disquiet. We want complete accountability and transparency in the process. Australia has a special relationship with China. They are our largest trading partner. We have many Chinese nationals studying in Australia, and there's strong cultural and other economic links with China. So we think we're in a position where, on a government-to-government basis, we should be able to make effective representations.
That's interesting to hear you say that, because in all the talk about this, there is always the kind of the pressure from the government. Is this being seen as a political case? Is he being made an example of because of his connection to Australia? You're saying that actually the strong links, economic links between Australia and China could actually help his case.
Yeah, it's not just the strong economic links. It's also the cultural links. We, as I said, we have a large Chinese population in Australia. They're the single biggest source of immigration to Australia at the moment.
That was Robert Sterry in Melbourne. Now, I'm sure lots of us have tuned into the radio in the middle of the night when we've been struggling to go to sleep, hoping the soothing tones of the announcer will lull us into a deep slumber. The only problem is news is often gripping, exciting and anything but soothing. But the Sleep Council here in the UK has teamed up with Penguin Books to offer a solution. Take a listen to this.
First, curl up. Get cozy. Take a deep breath and relax. Breathing in and out. In and out. And enter Topor. This friendly and tranquil place that sits on the shores of a vast inland lake. A lake that came from a volcanic eruption thousands of years ago. Now, it's a wondrous wild space of hills, trees, mud pools, and inlets dotted with bubbling thermal pools. Pools rich in minerals that you can slide into like the most private, quiet, and delicious bath that never runs cold.
Sorry, I just drifted off there. It was so relaxing. Shaima Khalil asked Lisa Artis of the Sleep Council how big a problem is insomnia around the world.
It's probably around 30 to 40% of people who are suffering from insomnia. And that can be from people who are obviously suffering from a kind of short-term insomnia to those who are suffering from like chronic insomnia. And chronic insomnia is defined as like anything kind of over sort of 3 to 6 months where you're suffering it from more than 3 times a week.
I presume people who used to tune into the radio in the middle of the night to sleep, that doesn't work anymore because there's so much news right now that's distressing, that also kind of demands your attention. So how does Sleep Tales work?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like you just said that, you know, the radio has got some maybe news on that's maybe either too stimulating or scary or whatever. But Sleep Tales have kind of been designed to, rather than being kind of a story that kind of has a beginning, middle and end, it's more of a narrative that's done very sort of soothing. And the sort of aim behind that was to kind of get people to kind of feel relaxed before bedtime. It, you know, it's not been designed to get people to fall asleep to, but we don't make that time to wind down properly before bed. Mm. And what we've done with this is try and say to people, look, you know, rather than sort of checking your work emails or scrolling through social media or maybe putting the laundry away or anything like that, why not just take 15 minutes to kind of just get the brain to kind of refocus, stop overthinking all the things that are going on in your life? Because you can't go to sleep when your mind is buzzing.
And it takes a special voice, I guess, to be able to achieve that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we worked hard to kind of find the right voice for this. You know, you want somebody who's quite soothing with dulcet tones, but nothing that's too monotone, but equally nothing that's got so much intonation in it that you're kind of going up and down with the speaker as well.
That was Lisa Artis of the Sleep Council. Now, in 2013, the one-woman play Fleabag premiered at the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland. Written and performed by the then unknown Phoebe Waller-Bridge, a few years later the TV version made her a star. And now Fleabag is back on the stage in London's West End. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd reports.
The box office at Wyndham's Theatre isn't yet open, but people heading the ticket queue have been outside since 4:30 a.m. to buy standing tickets for Fleabag on stage. Sophia, Brooke and Sam are 20-something Americans in London and big fans of the show Phoebe Waller-Bridge wrote for TV.
It's a brilliant piece of television and Phoebe Waller-Bridge is a genius, so I'm excited to see it.
I think it just touches something really human in all of us, and I think what's so great about the character Fleabag is that we're all her in some way.
It's so intelligently written.
Yeah.
At every moment you were both surprised and delighted by like what comes next.
Yeah.
It took 3 years to take Fleabag from the original one-woman show in Edinburgh to transatlantic TV success.
And then the next morning, you wake to find him sat on the side of the bed, gazing at you. He says that...
Last night was incredible.
Which you think is an overstatement.
Eleanor Turney saw it before all the hype. She reviewed it at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2013.
It was quite refreshing to see a one-woman show that was so honest. Obviously, that's kind of become the stock in trade of that show now, is that it is this honest and quite filthy and rude look at female sexuality, at female desire, at just being a young woman in the world. And I don't think the world has got any less confusing between 2013 and now, if you're a 20-something or early 30-something woman trying to kind of make your way.
Fleabag played in New York earlier this year, but this is the first time it's run in a commercial West End theatre. Most tickets cost the equivalent of $216, a lot for a 65-minute one-person show, yet the entire run sold out quickly. Phoebe Waller-Bridge has done no broadcast interviews this time, but she did speak in a British Council video about the success of Fleabag.
It felt very authentic to all of us making this show, and when I was writing it, I felt like there was something truthful in this about this woman's life, this woman's pain, this woman's humour. But I'm so lonely.
Before the preview performance I went to, the audience felt more like a crowd at a rock gig. Afterwards, I met up again with Sophia, Brooke and Sam. What had they thought, finally seeing Fleabag on stage?
Seeing her tell those stories live is such a different experience than seeing them on a TV show, and anytime she said something new, I was just so excited. Her physical comedy is amazing, and her accents and her impressions of all the characters that we now know and love, like, seeing her do them, I was so impressed with her, like, virtuosity.
And that report was from Vincent Dowd. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day. And you can use those miles toward travel expenses like flights, hotels, rental cars, and more. Just book and pay for your travel using your Venture Card and redeem your miles toward the cost. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USANA.